full of whatever. Embrace now. Gyanatimirandasya Gyanam Jana Shalakaya Chakshunun Militam Yenatashmi Sri Gurave Namaha Namashrestam Manumapi Suchiputram Atrasvarupam Rupam Tasyagrajamarupurim Maturim Radhakundam Girivaram Radhikamadhavasam Praptayasya Pratitagripaya Sri Gurum Tamnatosmi Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasandubhyayivacha Patitanam Pavanibhyavaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Nikhila Shruti Mali Ratnamalatiti Nirajita Padapankajanta Aji Muktakulairu Pashyamanam Paritastvam Harinam Samsrayami Anare Pitacharim Chirat Kirunayavatiranakalaham Samarpaitamunnatoshvalarasam Sabhakti Hari Purata Sundara Dyuti Kadamba Sandipita Sadahridaye Kandare Spuratu Vasachinandana Ajahnulambita Bhujo Vande Jagat Priya Karo Karuna Avataru Ladini Shakti Swarupaya Gauranga Suridaya Cha Bhakta Shakti Pradanaya Gadadhara Namostute He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastate Radhe Vrindavanadishe Karunamrita Vahini Kripaya Nija Padabjadasyan Mahim Pradiyatam Bhaktya Vihinaya Parada Lakshay Chiptaschakamaditarangamadhyay Kripa maitvam charanam prapanam vrinde namaste charanaravindam. Vrinde namaste charanaravindam. Pranam to all of you. Greetings from Shyampriya Kunj in the Swiss Alps. I'm here for the last 2 3 days. After having spent one very dynamic week in Sri Ananda Dham, as some of you may be aware of, we had the chance of sharing with many brothers and sisters, not only on Sri Krishna Janmashtami, which I hope you had a blessed celebration of, but of course, on other celebrations like the Abhirbhav Mahotsav of Srila Prabhupada, an exploration of different topics in connection to the themes of a recent book and many quests and explorations as well. Always my favorite immersion. So happy to be back in Q&A, quest and exploration with all of you today. And yeah, I'll be here for 2 weeks, some kind of solitary retreat. Last year I was here for 3 weeks. And it's interesting because last year I started writing my forthcoming book. The fourth one, forthcoming means who knows when, but the next one after the one I recently published, the writing of that one started here 1 year before, 1 year ago. And now I'm kind of going through the finished product, so to say, though still needs some refinement and addition. So it's always interesting to be back to the same place, quote unquote, the same, and meet some work that was started some time ago in that same place and to look back and look at the present moment and see how things continue to to unfold in the course of a year. So much happens. So much happens in a day. As the other day I was reading someone mentioning this example, like if your day is a microcosmos of your whole, the macrocosmos of your life, how is your day going on, basically, right? Because an invitation to live our lives in the way we live one day, because it's in one way it's enough of a symbol for us to shed light on how is our life going on. And so as an invitation to live each day with, yeah, fascination, gratitude, openness to everything. So hopefully, yeah, we are open enough for today's meeting for whatever needs to be given, be received, be exchanged. So I will invite you to present any quests, questions, ideas, thoughts, whatever you may like to bring to the table today. And I've heard that Rohini Sutta Prabhu, who is joining us today, along with Sumati, nice to see you both and all of you. He has a question, though the digital hand is not raised. We'll go to Rohini Sutta Prabhu first, and then we'll continue with some that is in him raising his hand. So, Rohini Sutta, please, you can unmute yourself. Welcome. Pleasure to have you here. Nice to see you again.
How's that?
That's good.
Good. Please accept my obeisances, Maharaj.
Please accept mine.
So my question comes about because we're reading your book.
Okay.
Every day, every morning, we're reading, and it's very slow reading because there's so many questions that come up. This using this word paradox is in a religious context is quite different. I think I've looked up the word three or four times in a dictionary, just trying to figure out what you mean. But my question is this: God is a love ever expanding. God is love ever expanding, from what I'm gathering. And the soul is a fragment of this ever expanding love. And all aspects of the soul originate from God, from this love. And one of the aspects would be free will. I mean, correct, if I'm saying something wrong, please correct me. But so how can the soul come up with some evil free will if it's all connected to love? The soul is a fragment of this love. I maybe that's the paradox. I don't know. But that's my question: how the soul can conceive of something evil and act on it. And
Yeah, thank you. And I'm glad that that you brought the word paradox, of course, to preface your question. Because there is paradox in everything, even in what we don't think there is paradox. If we don't find paradox in some things, that means we have not investigated them enough. But when we scratch the surface, we discover paradox as a as an operating blueprint of reality. Paradox. Which basically paradox, interestingly, in its etymology, as I always like to go to etymologies to know whomever created that word first time, what did they originally meant, right? So paradox, para means like beside or beyond or contrary to, and doxa means opinion from the Greek, right? Opinion, expectation, belief. So it's something like contrary to expectation. Or beyond belief, interestingly speaking. So something that goes against what people usually think, or a way of thinking that is not inside of the norm, but outside of the norm or outside of the box, which interestingly happens to be connected to the word ecstasy. right? Ecstasy means outside of the norm, outside of stasis, outside of the status quo. No? So ecstasy means something that is not what the masses do. Let's put it that way. So it's interesting for me to connect how these two words almost say the same thing, paradox and ecstasy. Well, we may not relate them entirely, but if we want to access the realm of ecstasy, anandam, paradox is the gateway to that, basically. If we do not embrace a paradoxical paradigm, a paradoxical worldview, we won't be able to deal with ecstasy. We won't be able to enter that secret realm because, as we were talking these days, ecstasy ultimately is another way of, or love, no, ecstatic love, let's put it that way. And so much is accommodated in that realm. So much that otherwise cannot be accommodated, cannot even be thought of. So paradox means this. Paradox means, and I will say it doesn't, it's not that first comes paradox. Probably first come contact with a certain type of love, with a certain type of heart that show us, oh, it's possible to reconcile these two things, to hold these two things at the same time. This person who has a bigger heart than me, whomever that person may be, a deeper heart, that person is able to hold what for me is contradictory and it's impossible. This person is coexisting with these two things, whatever they may be. And not only is it possible, but it's beautiful. So I will say by first contact with that love, in the form of that person, a loving person, we gain an experiential glimpse of what paradox look like, how paradox look like. Because if not, it can be just very conceptual, very theoretical, very informational. So once we have that experience, oh, we understand, oh, it's possible to give space, to create more spaciousness in my life, in my heart, to accommodate, to integrate, to reconcile what today seems irreconcilable. I will say it's, and I'm going to your question in a minute, right? This is just a warming up. I think that's a good question, a good daily meditation or prayer, right? Like, which new level of paradox am I invited to embrace today? What is that thing that I have not been able to embrace till now, to accommodate, to reconcile, to hold space for, that I am invited to give place to? Every day there is, that invitation is extended. Again, going back to your question, free will and love. Actually, we talked a little bit about that the other day. Interestingly enough, it seems to be a topic in the collective unconscious of the tribe. I think it was the very last meeting we had at Ananda Dam in the evening. I think it was Wednesday evening. We were talking about bhakti, we were talking about love, we were talking about whether bhakti is inherent or not, and if it's not inherent, do we still have the capacity for some type of love, though we may not label that as bhakti? And the question started with someone mentioning this classical, let's say, logic. Okay, we are generally described as part and parcels of Krishna. No? Krishna says in the Gita, 15th chapter, sorry, chapter, 15 verse 7 or chapter 7 verse 15. Now my memory went mixed. Mamayavam sujivaloke jivabhuta sanatana. No, I think it's chapter 7. Anyhow, the important point here is Krishna is saying the jivas, the souls, are my amsa, which sometimes is translated as fragmentary part or aspect. So of course, following that logic, we may say whatever qualities are there in the whole are there to be found in the part to some degree by logic. But logic is not everything, right? So then we have other, for example, Rupa Goswami mentioning 64 qualities of Krishna. But then he clarifies only the first 50 qualities are to be found in the jivas to a certain extent, not even fully as in Krishna. And there are other 14 qualities that are not fine found in us because we are not Krishna, basically, right? So the verse was 15:7. Sorry for the misquotation. So so that's an important point to consider. It doesn't mean that because we are Tathasta Shakti, one ray, so to say, one aspect of one particular energy of God, whatever Krishna has, we have in every sense of the term. Sometimes analogies are invoked, though analogies cannot prove the ultimate truth. And someone may say, well, whatever is contained in a drop, whatever is in an ocean, the drop is representing and is containing that. But we could say, no, you cannot do surfing in a drop, right? You don't find waves in a drop of water. You don't find jewels or whales inside a drop. You find those in the ocean, right? So in one sense, yes, the drop represents the ocean to some degree, but there is a point where certain qualities in the ocean are not found in the drop. So similarly, somehow what most resembles God is the soul, if we want to put it that way. But that doesn't mean that everything that Krishna has, we have. So there are some differences. One of them being, I will say, inherent bhakti, so to say. As I tried to share in my first book, it's not that the soul has inherent. We are not made of love for Krishna, let's put it that way. If we will be made that of such, we will be labeled as ragatmikas, according to Rupa Goswami's language. Ragatmika means someone whose atma is made of raga, or love for Krishna. But our tradition is raga anuga, to follow in the footsteps of those who are made of love of Krishna. So we can become imbued with love of Krishna. Bhakti is a gift. And yeah, there can be a nuance in the conversation, and we could say souls can express some form of love, selfless love for some beings in this world, but that's not the same as bhakti. No? So that there is some difference there, and we may need to use different terminology at times. So going to your question, though we may not have inherent bhakti, of course, we will say in our tradition that the ultimate fulfillment of the soul is somehow in connection to a form of love, in connection to a form of the absolute. There are different forms of love and different expressions of the absolute. So somehow our destiny, ultimate destiny, is tied to the notion of love. So why sometimes we see, especially human beings, let's be honest, no, we are not talking here much about other species, expressing their free will in a, how to say, terrifyingly bad way. Well, that's basically a confirmation of free will. That's the basic reply. I mean, the fact that we can do such horrible things means how free we are to choose to go in such an unexpected dark direction. That confirms the fact that we can choose to that an extent. And of course, indirectly, that's showing how we could choose in the opposite direction, right? The more degraded we become, the more we are indirectly confirming how high we can fly. So love is voluntary. Over and over again, we have to say this. If our free will wouldn't allow us to express that free will in a dark way, that wouldn't be a free will. Basically, if I tell you, you have free will, but you can only express it in the context of loving Krishna, that's not free will. That's quite partial will. No, there's only one option. You can love me. Maybe you can choose something in the context of how to love me, but not you cannot choose not to love me. That wouldn't be free will by definition. So free will by definition is, in our tradition, we will say we can choose what Jiva Goswami calls bahir mukhyata or sam mukhyata, to give our back to Krishna or to turn our face and all our faculties toward Krishna, and all the options in between that spectrum. And those two options have unlimited expressions as well. So basically that will be the reply. No? Love is voluntary. Krishna wants us, let's put it this way, Krishna wants you to freely choose to love him. That's the only love that makes sense to him. He doesn't want coercive love, manipulated love, love surrendering to God out of intimidation, out of pressure, out of fear, out of who knows what. He wants a free choice. Freedom. That's an important word in connection to love. Full freedom. So in our spiritual practice, we are trying to develop more and more freedom. Ideally, spiritual environments should support freedom. Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions that in his famous Bhagavad speech. That whole speech is basically a glorification of freedom. And the more free we are, the more meaningful is our choice of loving in Krishna in this case. So that will be the situation, right? We have free will, we have the chance of choosing. And having the chance of choosing means ch having the ch having more than one choice. Have many choices. And sometimes we unfortunately are too curious in the wrong direction. Let's put it that way. Of course, I would say curious. We are too misguided, too much under the influence of avidya, what we will call, too much in a state of ignorance, too much without proper parameters to reality, missing the mark, we will say, as I mentioned in my book. I speak about evil in a few pages in the book. And I mentioned that evil is missed potential. So even sometimes when we speak about evil, we should be very, at least our tradition, we try to be careful not to be extremely judgmental when we are saying what some people did was evil. I mean, we do not want to deny evil, but we do not want to judge people that may engage in evil acts in a way that we are basically branding them for eternity as evil do characters or something, because we all have done some evil. Again, evil is missed potential. We have a potential to express itself in the most virtuous ways possible, but we are expressing that potential in some other direction, and sometimes that takes the form of evil. But behind that evil is ignorance. We cannot separate. There are no intrinsic evil people according to our philosophy. As they are not, as the soul do not have intrinsic love of God, the soul do not have intrinsic evil either. Okay? Because if evil will be an intrinsic quality, we could never get rid of it because it's intrinsic. There's no hope for such person. They are made of evil. There are some traditions which may think like that, interestingly. That's another conversation. Even Vaishnava traditions who will think there are some inherently tamasic jivas who are destined for a perpetual ignorance. Wow, that sounds very too much to me, especially in the face of an all-merciful God. But anyhow, so there are no intrinsic evil souls. They are just covert souls, extremely covert souls, if you want to put it that way. But behind that extreme thick layered of covering, there is an amazing soul. Acharya, as Krishna will say in the Gita, every soul is amazing. Sometimes every soul is amazing, and sometimes souls, amazing souls are amazingly covert. Right? That's what Krishna says at the end of that verse when he says, some people hear of the soul as amazing. Some people speak of the soul as amazing. Some people experience the soul as amazing. But even more amazing than all that is that despite all this, some people still cannot fathom the amazingness of the soul. So that could be a way of referring to those who are amazingly covered, amazingly under a blanket of avidya or ignorance. And somehow they deserve our understanding and compassion. I'm not saying this to justify evil acts. We have to take action, but at the same time to understand what's behind that action. There is a amazingly covered, amazing jiva. So it's always important to not lose sight of the bigger picture. At the end of the day, yeah, we see evil, we see violence, we see hatred, we see revenge, we see bitterness, we see contempt, so many symptoms of the root problem, which is avidya. No, the root problem is not evil. No, because if evil is at the root, again, there is no hope. Right? If evil is the root of the whole thing, we are talking about evil being the root of something, but the root of all reality is not evil. It's avidya. And avidya, in one sense, means absence of knowledge or absence of awareness of love. Because vidya means can be translated as knowledge, but Krishna, the Bhagavad Gita, say Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam. Bhakti is the king of all knowledge. Love is the ultimate knowledge, the ultimate way of knowing anything. So avidya means absence of that. Which again confirms that bhakti is absent in the constitution of the soul, and we can do amazingly horrible things in that state of absence of love, avidya. We call that evil, we call that hatred, whatever we call it. But again, those are symptoms of our unawareness to the reality of love. That's why, interestingly, Jiva Goswami used the word sammukhyata, which means turn all your faculties toward Krishna. Srila Prabhupada will use the expression back to Godhead. We have been bahirmukhyata, we have been given our back to the Godhead for time without beginning now. Go back to him. That's basically the intention of the expression. So that's the price of love, interestingly. We don't want to blame love. We don't want to blame anyone. There's nobody to blame. That's a deep sobering lesson. Now, there's no need to play the blame game. It is what it is. Love is God. God is love. Love is voluntary. Therefore, it requires the free will is necessary to do free choices, and free choices entail the risk of not taking the most enlightened choice. And we have then symptoms as the ones you are asking about, evil and things like that. But none of these can represent any, thank God, constitutional attributes of anyone. So there is hope, and everything can be redeemed. And let's begin at home. No, let's hope there's hope. We can all be redeemed, no matter how evil we are, how misguided we are, how much we continue missing the mark, no matter how much avidya blankets are amazingly covering us, still the power of love, the power of grace and mercy is way more powerful. And all that, if and whenever we choose to, again, sammukhyata, look in that direction. So I don't know if that helps, Rohini Sutta, in any way. Maybe that could
Well,
be a question, and that's also a way of helping.
it's just very curious that love has the potential for evilness. It's
It's
maybe I'm,
paradox.
it's quite hard for me to wrap my head around it.
Yeah. Again, I wouldn't say that love has the potential for evil. But love is a voluntary decision. So whenever we do not choose love, then you have evil and the potential for evil. But in itself, in love, there is no evil. So that's important distinction. It's not that there's evil in love. No? In our tradition, we'll speak that there are so many emotions that are become expressions of love in the spiritual world, that are somehow integrated into the love equation, that may in other otherwise may sound like contradictory, like even envy, anger, pain, all that takes place in the ultimate reality of love. But we never hear that evil is expressed there. So again, it's not that evil is an aspect of love, it's that love is a voluntary decision. Because if we don't have love as a voluntary decision, that's another form of evil. Basically, if there's no choice, You are basically in a totalitarian regime. If I give you no option for evil and no option for anything except whatever option I'm giving you, that in itself is evil. So I know that may take time to wrap our heads around that, and not only our heads. And you started with the right word, paradox. So it's a paradox, but exactly, if we don't give the option, and I know it's risky to give option, to give freedom to people, it's risky. But I know you as a father know what I'm talking about. Do you have a daughter? You have to give your daughter some freedom to explore life. And there are risks involved in that. And as a parent, you may be concerned. What if she chooses the wrong way and ends up doing who knows what? Or but if in order to prevent that potential risk, you prevent her from taking any choices altogether, then that's evil. Right? Now, if you think, oh, but I will do that so she doesn't choose something that will be evil, but you are doing something evil to begin with. So as an act of love, you will risk that your daughter, I hypothetically, make some choices that may take her in an evil direction, though of course you will be there trying to support her for that not to happen. And that's what Krishna is doing. No? He loves us, he gives us that choice, and he's trying to go along with us. And whenever we miss the mark, as I like to say, like the GPS, recalculating, recalculating. Let's try to adjust the environment as much as possible so God can participate in our life, trying to help us to go back to hit the target. Anyhow, some thoughts. It's a great conversation to have on this topic, and so many more things we can say, but I will invite you now for a minute, for those who are joining us for the first time, between answers, between questions, between explorations, we have some breakout rooms, what I like to call breakthrough rooms. We invite each one of you to participate in groups of three approx and share further churning, continue to churn among smaller groups and getting to know each other more deeply about reflections that you may still have on this particular topic. I opened my mouth for a few minutes. Now it's your turn to open your mouth and hearts to one another for 10 minutes or so. So Bhakti Rasa will invite you now to those rooms. I hope you can all join. I will see each other in 10 minutes approx. Invite to share further turning on this particular theme. Hey, welcome back. Hoping you have a sacred kidnapping into the breakthrough rooms and honoring the name of them. Really breakthrough. Any more insight and enlightening one another. So that's it. Let's move forward to the next raised hand, the last one so far. So if any of you have any other things to share and present today, invite to do so. Still, we have some time. Sam, welcome one more time.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. I have a question about, you're probably familiar, chapter 3 in Bhagavad Gita, verses 36 to 37, in which Arjuna says, O descendant of Rishni, by what is one impelled to sinful acts, even unwillingly, as if engaged by force? Which now that I think about it, it seems to be following today's inquiry.
Yeah, interesting.
And Krishna's response, I don't know how much time we have, so I'm not going to read each shloka, but Krishna responds in discussing lust and that lust, the different degrees of lust can cover the living entity, and that a man's pure consciousness is covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire. My question is, when Krishna's talking about explaining to Arjuna about lust, and Prabhupada offers purports to expand on that, I wondered, what is this lust, that's considered the enemy of the soul?
Thank you. I will go for a minute to the original word here, which is kama. It's translated by last, as last, sorry, this verse by Srila Prabhupada and other acharyas as well. But also, it's important, as usual, for us to decipher, so to say, the how like to unravel, unpack the meaning of what do we mean by lust. Because for many of us, the word has very not only charged, weighty implications, but also sometimes very limited expressions. So for many of us, lust means sexual desire. And that's it. There is one mic on, Bhaktiras, I think. So that's an important point to make, that because sometimes when we are very reductionistic in defining words, we get into trouble because we just think, okay, lust is only this, and we may be missing the bigger picture in which kama expresses itself. So actually kama, or even if you want lust, though I will say how the word lust is understood, at least in the times we're living. Lust, I wouldn't use that word myself. I will use more a word like selfish or self-centered desire. Because that's what kama means. If you go to the original, and of course it can include sexual expression from a self-centered perspective. But the problem is that when you reduce kama to lust and lust to sexual expression and you don't clarify much in the context of that, then you end up saying all forms of sexual expression are the greatest enemy of the soul and this and that, and we end up with a dysfunctional culture of disembodied spirituality, basically. And there's a lot of that in Gaudiya Vaishnava community, to be honest. Not only in our community, but in our community as well. And many times one of the reasons will be that we understand kama or as lust and lust, a selfish desire, a sexual desire, and that's like the great problem. But the actual problem is self-centeredness. And that can take so many forms apart from sexual expression. So in one sense, it's a form of bypassing to reduce kama to just sexual desire, because there is and I see that happen in our community when, let's say, to give you any practical example, when someone who has accepted vows of monasticism for whatever reason is not able to follow those vows, there is an over zoom in that particular situation. Oh, that person fell down, which is even an expression I don't like to use. You may be falling upward if you have the proper attitude and you are learning from the experience. That person did that, and that person may not be doing that, but may be engaging in so many other forms of self-centeredness. But we don't say anything about them. But when someone transgresses the sexual, the carnal thing, whatever, oh, big scandal. And of course, with this, I'm not downplaying forms of abuse in the context of sexuality, nothing like that. I'm just saying, when we over hyper localize one thing in only one direction, we miss all the other expressions of that very thing that may be happening. Right? So we over stigmatize lust as sexual desire and invest all our evil projections in that particular act. So to give you an example, and we lose sight of how many other things are going on, which are way worse than that, and way more subtle and way invisible than that, like hypocrisy and self-deception and anyhow, toxic guilt and shame. For me, those things are really way more pervasive than some carnal shortcomings, so to say. So basically, that's the idea, right? Kama means self-centered desire. And that's why Krishna in the Gita says, Kama esa krodha esa. From kama comes krodha. Krodha will mean like anger. And in this context, anger means like frustration. And frustration means you are frustrated because you are trying to, if you want to use the word enjoy or use the word you want, pursue life from a self-centered perspective. And that's basically not possible. So therefore, you are trying to live an impossible life, and no surprise you will be frustrated because it will never work because you are not the center. So like you are saying, this verse is saying this enemy of lust is a way of using words, of course. Now we are not trying here to create like it some type of demon that exists there called lust, and it's your enemy and it's against you, so beware, it wants to make you fall at every step. No, it's just a way of depicting that dramatically, so to say. Because yeah, self-centeredness is never satisfied. This verse of the Gita said, this is an enemy that whose hunger is never satisfied, always wants for him. Because again, you are never satisfied because you are pursuing anything and everything from a wrong orientation, basically. Like Prabhupada would say, you're adding numbers, you add the first two numbers wrong, no matter how rightly you add the rest of the numbers, and result will be incorrect. So you, if your first step is avidya, missing the mark, as we were talking before, I am the center. No matter how carefully you plan each one of your subsequent steps, at the end of the day, at the end of the equation, the result is dissatisfaction because we are not the center. That's how Krishna defines to Brahma in the Chatur Shloki of the Srimad Bhagavatam, what is Maya, basically. Basically, Maya means that which is not possible. No, to try to live a life that is not possible, that's what we call illusion. No? Or sometimes nowadays you use this term, oh, that person is delusional. No? Which basically means that person is not living reality as it is. It's creating another reality that is not possible. So yeah, kama means that. Desire, sometimes in one way of translating is desire. In one sense, kama is not a bad word because desire is not a bad word. And there are many, you ultimately, Rupa Goswami will speak about the bhakti of Radharani and the gopis as kama rupa bhakti. So here we have the word kama coming back full circle. And that means they are the very embodiment of desire, but not self-centered desire. But all their desires are to give pleasure to the beloved. And that becomes the embodiment of the ultimate goal to attain, so to say. So that's the interesting thing. Both times the word kama is used. In one sense, we hear the word your enemy, insatiable, monstrous, the worst of the worst, and then the same word kama to refer to the love of Radharani and the gopis. And those who follow them are Kamanuga Bhaktas, filled with desire. And because again, if we misread kama as desire, even not as lust, and that's wrong, then all forms of desire are wrong, and then you are basically out of the bhakti journey, which is all about desire. As Prabhupada will say, this is not the science of detachment, it's the science of attachment. Though generally we use the word attachment negatively, but we have to be able to find the positive expression of attachment, find the positive expression of desire, and I will say find the possible expression of lust, if you want to use some shocking expression. No, you have to have, I've heard that expression a few times, like a lust for life or something like that. Again, as long as it's not self-centered, you can use all whatever words you use. At the end of the day, it's a word only. The words are pointing to a reality. So when the reality becomes the problem, no matter which words we use, it's a problem. When we are living reality from a properly oriented place, no matter which words we use, it's a solution. So that's basically what karma means. In this case, in this context that you are sharing this verse of the Gita in chapter 3, and generally how Krishna uses the word kama in the Bhagavad Gita mostly, to indicate self-centered desire, based on a true, on a sorry, on a false self, on a false sense of identity, what sometimes we call false ego, of some based on a sense of self that we are not and that we cannot be, which again I like to call an impossible life. So when we have that idea right, then there is no need to be against the world anymore, basically, so to say. No, there is no need to be against lust, be against desire, be against anything. Everything finds its proper place. And again, if we are too much against all forms of love, romanticism, sexuality, if I may, we won't be able to appreciate the ultimate expression of romantic love that we find between Radha and Krishna. And it's okay, we cannot jump into that prematurely because we may still have a self-centered idea of sexuality. That's why our acharyas prevent us, do not rush into the intimate descriptions of the erotic pastimes of Radha and Krishna. Why? Because probably you are carrying self-centered notion of sexuality and you will project that into that, and that will create a big distortion. But sexuality in itself is not a problem, it's just self-centeredness. As nothing else is a problem but self-centeredness, again, which is a symptom of avidya. When I see that everything revolves and converges in me, which is such a huge no, such a huge exhausting labor, right? Like the other day we were talking in Ananda Dham with Krishna Chandra Prabhu, and he was talking about separateness or separation from Krishna. Of course, in one sense, we cannot exist separated from the divine, from our source, but we live as if that's possible. Again, illusion, an impossible life. And that's such an exhausting thing to do. And I recall one poem by Hafiz, and I quoted that the other day. And he says that basically very interestingly. He says, us, basically, conditioned souls by avidya, trying to live an impossible life of self-centeredness. And he says, just sit there right now. Don't do a thing. Just rest. And we may be curious, all like, why all that? Why such welcoming? Why such insistence of resting and taking a break? And then he reveals the rest of the poem. He says, for your feeling separate from God can be the hardest work in this world. So the fact that you are bearing such an impossible life is such an exhausting thing. So please take rest. That's how the saintly, the enlightened ones see us. No? They realize, wow, you're traveling life after life and trying to live an impossible life. Such a long journey, such a long impossible journey. You must be so tired. It's like trying to swim against the current of a strong river for 3 billion lifetimes. You will be pretty tired. But somehow you were not informed that there is another way of swimming and that you can be carried by the current and trust the current. So far you have not received that perspective, so you are still going with your only option, avidya. So the enlightened one sees as, oh, take rest for a minute, please. So basically, that's avidya, that's karma in the negative connotation. But when we realize the positive expression of them, then we can celebrate everything in life. And enjoyment and desire are no longer bad words. They just need to be, how to say, located around the proper center. So the missing of the mark is the missing of the center. Self-centeredness is another way of saying missing the center. So that's what makes desire a problem. That's what makes anything a problem. That we are seeing things through the lens of us being the center, an impossible, exhausting reality. So anyhow, I'll invite you now to take some rest, deep breath, go to the breakout rooms, share with each other, give a hug to each other, share some tea through the chat somehow or other, support each other, tend to each other. We are all coming from a long journey, but now the journey is we are starting to trust the current, and we can swim in the proper direction, and we know these are rivers of grace that can carry us to our destination. So there's reason to celebrate. So get together in our breakthrough rooms, have some breakthrough. See you in a few minutes. If there is anything else to share, and if not, we'll put some nice closing to our sharing. So welcome back, and I hope you had a nourishing, rich sharing. We have a few more minutes if anyone has something else you would like to share today. Can be a question, it can be anything and everything. If it feels like there is some missing preparation in the tables, some missing spice in the masala, if you feel that call, now is the moment. And Sumati has some final spice to make our masala successful today. She's a good cook, so fasten your seatbelt.
I just want to express my gratitude. It's just that Krishna has sent you into the world at this time to, especially for so many of us that were conditioned and raised in Krishna consciousness in a more restrictive, closed atmosphere and understanding of Shastra. And I can't say that as a general thing because it depended on who your association was. But anyway, that you have like a sun rising out of a dark, dark oceanic scene, just opening the door to a broader understanding of who Krishna is and who we are in relationship to Krishna and everyone, all living beings, and emphasizing love, that which is, it is the desire within all of our hearts to love, to feel expansive while loving, and to be able to receive love. And you're now expressing what our hearts have been waiting to hear for a long time, and I'm just so grateful, and thank you, and I hope to participate more often. I've still been adjusting to a whole new life for me, and this has been, I've had some nice exchanges with Bhadra, who I've never spoken to before, so it's anyway, I see the family expanding, expanding, and I'm just happy to be part of it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You are the elder member of the family, the eldest. Not to make you feel old, but you are our old
82.
grandmother, so you're all taking shelter in your wings. Please protect us. Thank you. Thank you, and at the same time, not thank you in the sense that thank you is just two words put together that never convey what exists beyond gratitude, as Srila Siddharamaraj will say beautifully, right? Like when we say thank you, we entail that someone is giving me something to me The giving is from one side and the receiving is on another side. So still we are thinking in terms of two parties. But in the ultimate reality we want to participate, there is no two parties. So the giving and the receiving is all one thing, right? Like I was talking the other day with Krishna Chandra and he was giving me a donation and I was giving him the donation back. He was putting it again in the pocket in another way. And at the end, we were like, it's all the same pocket. That was the conclusion, right? It's all the same pocket. Right? So it's not going in any different direction. It's all serving the same common cause. So we don't need any longer to think about separate interests. That's such a huge relief, again, from a life, exhausting life of separation. So.
And it's interesting too, because I mean, I am watching more things like musical things and other people speaking, and it's just amazing how many people now are outside of our communities speaking of paradox and really putting yourself in uncomfortable situations, because that's the only place to grow. And it's like a zeitgeist that's happening all over the planet from what I'm now seeing in different locations and through different mediums. And
yeah, we are happy to be part of that wave and paradoxical wave. The path existed always, but yeah, sometimes we don't yet have the words to name it. And sometimes I was listening today in the morning one, the last episode of the podcast with Father Richard Rohr, and he was saying that sometimes if we don't have the word to name something, we cannot have the experience of that something. Right? I mean, something simple, but we don't have a word, a concept to conceive that such a thing exists, we miss the experience of the thing. So
oh,
a word like paradox allows us to have an experience of paradox and be okay with the paradoxical experience, because before that we may have been having those experiences but labeling them as wrong, contradictory, dualistic, confusing, blah blah blah, and probably the right word in some cases at least was paradoxical. And then we go make full circle and realize, oh, our whole philosophy starts with that word, achintya vida abhida tattva. Achintya is a word that you can translate as paradoxical. So our whole system, metaphysical, philosophical, theological school starts with that word, right? Paradox. That's the first word of our tradition, so to say. So better we get along well with paradox, because that's the defining term of our lineage. So, yeah. Reconciling, accommodating, more gear, holding more and more space, yeah, daily sacred beauty. I'm seeing that Jayadev Prabhu, who I think is joining us for the first time, we met a few weeks ago in Germany. He's raising his hand, so we'll invite him to unmute, and after that, probably we'll put our sharing to rest today. But please, Jayadev Prabhu, welcome. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Swami Padmanabha. Thank you for this beautiful meeting and for the beautiful opportunity to meet others in the breakout rooms. I really, really appreciate that beautiful experience tonight. And I don't know if there's a space for this one more question, which is, you were referring to avidya as the absence of knowledge, and at the same time you added absence of love. And I wanted to ask you how it is related, the absence of knowledge and the absence of love.
Okay, yeah, let's transgress our usual timing and go a few minutes beyond that. Hope you are with me on this one. to honor Jayadev Prabhu's question. So basically I connected these two because okay, based on this verse from the Bhagavad Gita, right? Chapter 9, verse 2. Very beautiful verse. Each word is significant there. So much there. Rajavidya, Rajaguhyam Pavitramidamuttamam Pratyakshavagamam Dharmyam Sursukham Kartumabhyayam. We can spend hours going through each one of those words. Not today, sorry. But the first two words we will spend a few minutes. Rajavidya. So Krishna says, he's speaking about Bhakti, chapter 9. That's the name of the chapter. Rajaguhya Yoga, the yoga of the highest secret, the king of all secrets. And Rajavidya means the king of knowledge. So he's speaking about bhakti, which in a general way we can translate it as devotion or love. So he says love is the highest knowledge. So when I say avidya, we generally relate vidya with knowledge. And here Krishna is saying the highest knowledge is love. So you ultimately, avidya means absence of love. Because what's the purpose of knowledge without love? We don't want just to be mere how to say depository, like recipients of facts and accumulate information. I mean, we have social media today, AI, so much information, but there's no love there, though we may think there is, but there's not. So real, the ultimate knowing happens through love, and when there is so much love, all other expressions of knowing recede to the back. That's why when you reach the place of the highest love, according to us, a place like Vrindavan, and you take a look at these people there who had the highest form of knowing, the king of knowledge, love in its ultimate expression, they know so much through loving that basically they don't know through anything else. And they all seem like an uncivilized tribal village. Right? That's how the Brajavasis look. No? Some of them, they don't know how to read, whatever. But they know how to love Krishna to the maximum degree, to the point that makes Krishna forget about his godhood, as we were talking the other day in Switzerland. That's a pretty powerful identity. If you are a god, that's no joke, right? How can something make you forget that you are God if you are God, actually? If there is something that makes God forget that he's God, then that something must be something. And that's love, of course, right? That's love. And that's a very particular type of love, not even every type of love, because again, in many cases, love reaffirms the idea that God is God for us and for God. And it's okay, we are not criticizing that. It's a flavor of love, but there is a type of a flavor of love that is of such nature that is not satisfied with knowing God as God, but with knowing God as He is. Krishna stu bhagavan swayam. That's the love of the Vrajavasis. They do not know Krishna as God. If you tell go them and try, as Uddhava tried to do when he went to Vrindavan, as we know, he came to Vrindavan with a bunch of vidya, with a bunch of knowledge. And that was all useless in one sense. And he thought, I'm going to Vrindavan to educate these Brajavasis with knowledge about who Krishna is. And he then realized, oh no, Krishna sent me here for me to get an education from these people who seem to be uneducated, but they love him in such a way that I don't know what to do with it. Like four heads of Brahma spinning, Brahma Vimohan Lila. Uddhava Vimohan Lila. You have all these great personalities, Indra Vimohan Lila, so to say. All these big guys with knowledge, position, power, they get a glimpse of Vrindavan. All their knowledge is reduced to ashes because they are confronted with the king of knowledge. So that's the connection between loving and knowing. When you love someone, you know that person to the marrow, as they will say in English, right? If I love you, I may have missed all the technical details of your existence. I may not know your passport number, but if I love you, I know you. And I may know all the technical stuff, like Google have all our technical information, all your information, they have it, though you don't know that. But they don't, if Google doesn't love you, so Google doesn't know you, so you can relax. They still do not know who you are. If we are a little bit concerned, they know all about me. until and unless they love you, they do not know all about you. So in that sense, love and knowing are synonymous ultimately. The highest form of knowing is loving. That's why Brahma said, Jnana prayasamodapasyanamanta eva. At one point, he said, reject Gyan, the ordinary way of knowing things, and namanta eva, just put your head on the ground and offer loving dedication to Krishna. That's a higher form of knowing. So by contrast, if that's clearly stated, knowing and loving, then not knowing, avidya, ultimately refers to not loving. If knowing ultimately refers to loving, not knowing ultimately refers to not loving. It's not just I'm missing some data. I'm in ignorance. Of course, we are not against knowledge and being educated, so we can learn to love. All the knowledge we received, all the concepts, all the ideas are for them to be internalized in such a way that they become a living, vibrant reality of love. If not, your head is getting in the way of your heart. That's not the purpose. So we have to be very careful what we are doing with all the information we are receiving, even spiritual information. It's still information if it does not instill transformation, right? So yeah, that was an interesting insight that came some time ago. Well, speaking about avidya, which basically means avidya, right? Lack of, absence of knowledge. And you play out the implication, what's knowledge to the highest degree? Love. So absence of love, it's another way of speaking about the tragedy of being a conditioned soul, basically means we are living unaware of the reality of love. Again, love is knocking on our door. Love is extending itself to our lives as much as it can without canceling our free will. But we have to do our part, which sometimes is look in the right direction and extend our hand to receive the gifts. So Srila Siddhar Maharaj once said, Krishna is already giving us everything we need and much more on a golden plate. But the only thing he's requesting from us, which he cannot do, is extend your hand to receive the gift. Sounds simple, but so far we are traveling for a few lifetimes and we have not been fully able to do that. Because of course, extending the hand to receive the gift is not any a gift, it's a very special gift. And it's costless, but it's not priceless. So accepting the gift implies realizing that there's nothing I can do or give back to deserve this gift, to earn this gift. The more I try to give, the more indebted I become, the more humbling this I become, and the more my false sense of self becomes dismantled completely. And if I do not want that to happen, then that feels like a problem. Well, that's the ultimate solution. But if I'm not properly, situated, that will feel like the worst thing of all. And we will be so scared and escaping from the death of the false self. That's why, again, some knowledge coming with love, not only knowledge, but loving knowledge, can educate us about the need for the disease of our false self in sustainable installments. So we can be less and less terrified about the nature and the invitation of the gift that Krishna wants to give us, which is an invitation to an eternal adventure of love, which has a price to pay, of course, a beautiful price, that it's never enough because the gift always supersedes all our effort to do give something back, but still we cannot but try. No? We have hope against hope, so to say. And that's not only for us, but as we say these days, Krishna feels exactly the same. That's the most astonishing thing of them all. Krishna himself feels an eternal debtor, but he's willing to play the game and to pay the price to try to do his best as much as he can. So yeah, we are on that journey now from avidya to vidya, from ignorance to enlightenment, from knowledge to the king of knowledge. So that's a very heroic, glorious journey. So we should feel very excited, very, how to say, very much looking forward to the next unfolding of the chapter, right? So those will be some thoughts. Again, maybe I don't have enough time as I will do earlier to expand more, but I hope that helps. Jayadev Prabhu, thank you so much for your question. And let's take 10 more minutes, one last breakthrough room, why not? And share among yourselves, since we are touching on this very touchy subject in the good sense of the term, the king of knowledge, love, and all that it implies for us, for God. Please be loving and generous with one another and spend a few more minutes together, disclosing your hearts, enriching each other. See you in a few minutes for our temporary farewell till next meeting. Welcome back, you all, and always for me a great feast to witness your beautiful smiling faces after your honest sharing. So thank you for giving me the darshan. And one more time, my great fortune to share with you every week, and not only every week, every day, share the journey together. Thanks so much for coming. Looking forward to meet each one of you next Saturday. And keep in touch in whatever we may be of service. The gratitude, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Samaveda Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Hari Bol, Vancha Kalpataru Vyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyeva Cha, Pritanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah.